We're going to enter hour number 6 of Learn the Bible in 24 Hours. In the land, the books of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. And great, great stuff. Now, we've now left the Torah. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy are now behind us from our review point of view. And the first three of the 12 historical books are now in our horizon here. And we're going to go beyond the Exodus to the conquest of Canaan and the time of the judges. Hour number 6, Joshua, entering the land, overcoming the land. And one of the things we're going to look at a little bit, did the sun really stand still? A lot of people have trouble, you know, the sun stand still. Come on, get serious. I'm a math science major. I have a doctoral level graduate work, and I believe every word of it. I'll show you why. Entering the land, overcoming the land, and dividing the land are, in some respects, the three major themes in Joshua. Then we go to the book of Judges. 450 years of doing what was right in their own eyes. You want to find out where value relativism leads? Well, just look at the book of Judges. That term, what was right in their own eyes, is the term in the Bible that describes the lowest ebb of morality ever witnessed. And we're going to see the pattern in Judges of sinning, suffering, repentance, and then deliverance as far as Israel is concerned. The dessert in this menu is this charming love story, Ruth. A charming love story in its own right. It's venerated in many literature classes as an elegant love story, and yet it is every line in it is full of encryptions and interest that you don't need a computer for it. You can decipher yourself, blow you away. It'll be a lot of fun. That'll be our target to get through in this hour. Book of Joshua. I love the book of Joshua. It's a military book. First five chapters, entering the land. And Joshua's the eldest son of Nun. Because he was the eldest son, now picture this. You remember he was with Moses, right, in Exodus. He was the eldest son. Did he have a special interest in the death of the firstborn? You bet. You bet, 40 years ago. But that was 40 years ago. He's now in charge. The next seven chapters will be overcoming the land. And then occupying the land, the victory of faith that we'll deal with in the book of Joshua. Entering the land, the first thing they did, of course, is cross the Jordan. And as they crossed the Jordan, among other things, Joshua had 12 stones representing the 12 tribes. He does this twice, actually, interestingly enough. Now, this monument of 12 stones is incidental to the story, and yet I think it's very provocative. Because when we get the New Testament, John the Baptist is baptizing. Where is he baptizing? In the Jordan. In fact, he is baptizing specifically in a place called Bethabara. The word means house of passage. John 1:28, these things were done in Bethabara beyond the Jordan where John was baptizing. Now, it's interesting in another account in Matthew where John the Baptist is getting confronted by his adversaries. He makes a remark in the same location. Say, you say that you have Abraham for a father. I say unto you that God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. Most people don't connect the dots. The stones he was probably pointing to were the very stones that Joshua established over 1,000 years earlier. But anyway, we'll move on, crossing the Jordan and so forth. Let's move on to the first thing he does at Gilgal, or the west side of the Jordan, is circumcision. For 40 years, the nation Israel had not been circumcised. Now, he is in a military conquest. He is on enemy territory. He's at war with the indigenous inhabitants of the land. What a strange thing to do, to put his menfolk in vulnerability by having to recover from an adult circumcision. But he's obedient to the law of God, and so he circumcises. That's also where manna ceases. Manna provided for them during the wilderness wanderings. This is when it stops because they're now in the land. They're their destiny. Now, there's a very strange event that occurs at the end of chapter 5 that most people miss. How many have heard the song, Joshua Fought the Battle of Jericho? Have you heard that song? You know it's wrong? He didn't lead the Battle of Jericho. Who led the Battle of Jericho? Anyone know? Jesus Christ. Exactly right. I visualize Joshua walking around in the evening after dinner, and he encounters this guy with a sword drawn. Who are you? Are you for us or our enemies? This is, I am the captain of the Lord's host. Take off your shoes, you're on hallowed ground. That's pretty exciting. See, we think of captain as a field grade officer. No, the term here really means the commander of the whole bunch. And take off your shoes, you're on hallowed ground. You know, that's a phrase Joshua would remember occurred at Mount Sinai back 40 years ago. Angels never allow themselves to be worshipped. Several places in Scripture, in Revelation twice, John wants to worship an angel. He says, see thou, do it not. Angels won't let them. There's one exception. I won't get into Lucifer here. We'll get into that later. This visitor orders himself to be worshipped. So who is this visitor? Has to be. Has to be. None other than our Lord Jesus Christ. And we're going to see references to that in the prophecies, that God will go fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle. When did Jesus Christ fight in the day of battle? Here in Joshua chapter 6, which follows this thing. Take off your shoes. So who really fought the battle of Jericho? Jesus Christ. One of the things that startled me, because I put a great significance on the names, is the name of this book is Joshua. Yes, it's Joshua's name, but you know what Joshua is in Greek? Jesus. Joshua is the Hebrew, Yehoshua. Conquest of Canaan. Of course, Jericho, of the nations, there were originally 10 nations. 3 have been put down already under the days of Moses. There's 7 left. And these 7 nations, the strongest of them are the Amorites. And the Amorites' capital is this place called Jericho, which means, by the way, the house of the moon god. And how interesting it is that Jericho today is the capital for the PLO. But we'll move on. We'll talk about the conquest of Jericho, the failure at Ai. They have a great setback. We'll talk about the battle of Beth Horon. That's where the sun stood still. And then they divide the land. That's what we're going to get into. Bet Yarah, the house of the moon god, is what Jericho stands for. Joshua does something kind of interesting. He sends in 2 spies. We call them spies. Now, these 2 spies go in there to Jericho to spy it out, and they get sheltered by Rahab. She hides them, lies for them, and gets them out of there safely. Now, what did the spies accomplish? Did they bring back intelligence upon which Joshua built his battle plan? Hardly. These spies didn't accomplish a thing except they got Rahab saved. Rahab of the whole bunch is going to be saved. So I wouldn't call them spies, I'd call them witnesses. Now wait a second here. We have a military commander taking God's people to dispossess the land of the usurpers. And the first thing he does is send in 2 witnesses. We're going to discover that there's a 7 trumpet business that's going to happen. I'm going to suggest to you, I'll tell you where I'm headed. I can't find anyone else that agrees with me. I've looked at all the commentaries. I've talked to some of the prominent guys that I respect in biblical exposition. And I can't find anyone that can find evidence of anyone having written a commentary on the view that the book of Joshua is an anticipatory model of the book of Revelation, where another Yehoshua, on behalf of his people, dispossessed the planet Earth of the usurpers, sending in 2 witnesses, and so forth. And we'll talk about the parallels when I'm finished here. The battle plan. Visualize the staff meeting. Joshua calls his generals together. Okay, guys, here's what they're going to do. We're going to march around the city once a day for 6 days, keeping quiet. Silence is a key part of this. On the 7th day, we're not going to observe Shabbat. We're going to march 7 times on the 7th day. And then we're going to blow our trumpets and yell, and the wall is going to fall down. I would love to see an expression on his military commanders. The boss isn't playing with a full deck here. We got a problem. Seriously, I imagine they were quite skeptical. I mean, can't we even have a few tanks or bazookas? Something here. No. And by the way, you're not to take any spoil. This is a very special deal. By the way, almost every rule in the Torah is violated here. 6 days they work, 7th they rest. Not here. The 7th they did 7 times as much. The Ark of the Covenant was not supposed to go to war. Here it leads the procession. And on it goes. There's many other things. They do all that. The walls do find, they take, and of course Rahab is spared because she gave hospitality to the spies when they needed it. They did so well at Jericho. The next was a smaller town called Ai. And here's the lesson here. They had confidence in themselves. Why did they succeed at Jericho? Because they were so clever, so military strong? No, because they had confidence in the Lord. What happened at Ai? They had confidence in the self. They underestimated the enemy. They thought maybe 3,000 people are sufficient. They were routed. They lost 36 men. This is the only loss in the entire 7-year campaign of Canaan, the conquest of Canaan. They are really in big trouble. Joshua, of course, goes to prayer, and I love what the Lord told Joshua. Hey, get up. What are you lying on your face for? You don't need me. You guys screwed up. Deal with it. That's in effect what he's saying. And so they cast lots. They discover that a guy by the name of Achan had smuggled some forbidden loot, violating God's injunction. They were not to take any spoil. Achan saw a Babylonian garment he thought was pretty cool, so he took it. There was sin in the camp. One guy did one thing, and it caused them to get clobbered. Is there a lesson there? So after stoning Achan and his family and his belongings, get that, they took a second attack. 30,000 men with 5,000 men ambush force to wipe out the city, and they succeeded. Well, I won't get into all the battles. As a military person, they're very interesting, but let's take the most interesting of them all, the Battle of Beth Horon. What happens in the meantime, by the way, some people called the Gibeonites, they make a deal with Joshua. Joshua was not supposed to make a deal with anyone in the land. What these Gibeonites did, they deceived Joshua. They tore their clothes so they looked old and dirty. They got themselves all messed up so it looked like they had traveled a long way. So they get Joshua to believe that they're from a foreign country, but they make a peace with Joshua and get Joshua to pledge to protect them. And Joshua's people do. They later find out that they've been tricked, but they honor their pledge. In fact, the Battle of Beth Horon comes about because these Gibeonites are being attacked by their neighbors who are teed off because they made a deal with Joshua. So they send to Joshua, hey, you promised to defend us. We're in trouble. Come help us. Now, if you or me were there, we'd say, wait a minute, you guys tricked us. Nuts to you guys. Bug off. No, these people honored their state because they made a commitment. Now, it's interesting that the kings that they're against confederate themselves under a leader who calls himself Adonai Zedek. He's the king of Jerusalem. Adonai Zedek means the Lord of Righteousness, and he's the king of Jerusalem at this point. Now, it's interesting that the Battle of Beth Horon, and I won't go through all the details of how they get there and all that, but they march very quickly. The enemies are defeated by stones of fire from heaven. That's pretty wild. They've got these guys on a run, but the day isn't long enough to get all of them. Some days are just not long enough for Joshua's victories. So he prays, he says, he commands the sun to stand still. Why? To give them more time to complete the rout of their enemies. And the scripture tells us the sun and the moon, incidentally, the moon is in the valley of Ajalon, that's near the horizon, extended for an entire day. They got almost an extra whole day, extra time. Now the kings end up hiding in a cave and are dealt with separately. And this battle completes the southern part of the strategy. The rest of the conquest, which is substantial, is really a mop-up. And we'll cover that in a little bit. But what's this business about the sun standing still? You've got to be kidding. But let's back up and try to find out what we can learn about this issue. Did you know that virtually all ancient calendars are based on 360-day years? I can give you 14 cultures that have their calendars, ancient calendars, based on 360-day years. As near as we can tell, all these ancient calendars changed after 701 BC for some reason. Something must have happened to cause these calendars to prove inadequate after 701 BC. Now, by the way, this is when the Romans added 4 1/4 days. This is when the Hebrews added a month on a schedule 7 times every 19 years. It's a very weird formula. The rabbis, there's ancient rabbinic literature that speculate, why did Hezekiah adopt this weird formula? Well, that's part two of the question. Part one is, why did he have to change it at all? What happened in 701 BC to cause these? Something else we learn. Did you know that Mars was worshipped by all the ancient cultures? Now, you and I live in a space-age day. We probably know more about space and astronomy than any culture on the face of the Earth. How many of you could go out there tonight and point to the planet Mars? Maybe a few. I don't see any hands, but a few of you, if you're in astronomy or take an astronomy magazine, you have some sensitivity, you might be able to do it, but I imagine there isn't one person in 1,000 in today's culture that would know Mars if he saw it. Yet the ancient cultures trembled over Mars. The Hebrew name was Baal. The worship of Baal was the worship of Mars. Mars was considered the god of war. We have it in our vocabulary today. Martial arts, right? Why? Because it interfered in their lives. There's a hypothesis of a near passby. Now, this hypothesis isn't by some off-the-wall crazy guys. This is by the guy that teaches celestial mechanics at Harvard, one of the guys that programmed some of the stuff for our space. These are three guys, Don Patton, Steinhauer, and Ron Hatch, wrote a book on the Long Day of Joshua where I got these materials. I know Don Patton personally, lives in Seattle. They have carried these analyses. They have elaborate computer models they've built to satisfy themselves that this all makes sense. I'll tell you what the hypothesis is. The idea is they've discovered from orbital mechanics that orbits have resonance. Just like a tuning fork has resonance. Those of you in music know how a tuning fork can pick up a resonant vibration across a room. Orbits are the same way. The conjecture is that Earth was originally on a 360-day year and Mars was resonant on the Earth on 720-day years. The model suggests that they made a near passby every 108 years. This would account for catastrophic events on a number of occasions in history that are a multiple of 108 years apart. Now, according to their model, every time there was a near passby, there'd be an energy transfer. If one was leading the other, it would be in one direction. If one was lagging the other, it'd be the other. But there was energy adjusting as they had these near passbys. But stability was attained finally after the near passby that occurred in 701 B.C. By the way, to give you a long day, you don't have to stop the spin. You just have to change the precession a little bit of the Earth. That's another thing that's not obvious until you've studied it. Mars are near passbys. The idea is the Earth was on a 360-day orbit around the sun. Mars was on a 720-day orbit around the sun. So they were resonant orbits originally, but that caused them to have near passbys. One of the passbys would be in the spring. If this passby occurred, it would be on March 20th or 21st. It would be inside after perihelion, after being nearest the sun. And the one that's ahead loses energy. The Earth would gain energy, Mars would lose it on this kind of a passby. The other passby that would occur where the orbits would come nearby is in the fall on October 25th. These are 108 years apart or multiple thereof. It comes from Mars comes from the aphelion, from the furthest distance from the sun. It passes behind the Earth, so Mars gains energy, Earth loses it. So each time there's an adjustment in the orbit in 701, presumably they stabilized. Now, after they're stabilized, the Earth is on a 365-and-a-quarter-day orbit. There's still some fractions yet to be accounted for, and they've got some analysis going on with Saturn. I won't get into that here. But this is where Mars declines, then. They've lost the energy down to 687 from the original 720. That's the model. The model's quite elaborate, quite impressive. Do you know what seems to validate the model? Lemuel Gulliver. How many of you are familiar with Gulliver's Travels? Huh? That's a children's story, right? Well, Gulliver, of course, is a fictitious character written by Jonathan Swift. Jonathan Swift was an Irish satirist. They weren't intended to be children's stories. They were satires on the politics in London. But, of course, we are not sensitive to that unless you've done some homework. Let me step back a little bit and tell you about telescopes. Early telescope. The telescope was invented by Galileo in 1610, and he discovered the four moons of Jupiter and Saturn's rings. Herschel in 1781 discovered Uranus. By 1787, it's improving. Herschel discovered two moons of Uranus. 1789, two more moons of Uranus. In 1846, Leverrier discovered Neptune and one of its moons. In 1877, this is the interesting date. Asaph Hall, using a brand new telescope at the United States Naval Observatory in 1877, made astronomical history by discovering the two moons of Mars. Named Dimas and Phobos, those were fear and panic in Greek. The astronomy world didn't know there were moons on Mars because they're not very big. One's only 8 miles across, and they're almost black. They don't reflect much light. They have an albedo, a reflectivity of less than 3%. Deimos is an almost synchronous orbit, 30 hours and 18 minutes, and Phobos rotates backwards, 7 hours, 39 minutes, period. 8 miles in diameter, 3% reflectivity. Now, here's what's so puzzling. Jonathan Swift, he lived from 1667 to 1745. In 1726, he published his book called Gulliver's Travels. Most of us are familiar with the first voyage of Gulliver, of the little tiny people, the Lilliputians. The third voyage of Gulliver is to Laputa, another land. What's interesting is when Gulliver lands in Laputa, the astronomers in Laputa brag that they know about the two moons of Mars, and the astronomers in London don't know anything about them. In fact, in the story, Jonathan Swift details the size, the revolutions, and the orbits of the two moons of Mars within less than 20% accuracy. I mean, not bad. Now, the problem is, of course, Jonathan Swift published in 1726. The two moons of Mars were discovered by Asaph Hall in 1877. Jonathan Swift describes the two moons of Mars 151 years before they're known to the world of science. The problem is, how do you explain this? Is it possible that people knew about that and the astronomers didn't? I don't think so. In fact, I doubt that Jonathan Swift really knew of them either. The only conjecture that makes sense is that Jonathan Swift probably had access to records that he used to embellish his fictional story. He probably didn't realize that there really were two moons of Mars. He just used it as color for his story. Do you follow me? It's the only thing that makes sense. Now, but here's the thing. The only way that someone with a naked eye could see the two moons of Mars without a telescope is for Mars to pass by as close as those computer models were assuming. So now let's take a look at Joshua. Now we're in the Battle of Beth Horon. There's a third of a million men in this battle. On October 25th of 1404 BC, Mars is on a polar pass at about 70,000 miles distance from the planet Earth. It rises from the horizon apparently about 50 times the size of the moon. There are severe earthquakes and landslides and meteorites accompanying it, and bolides. Bolides is a meteorite, it's chemical, it explodes when it hits. Earthquakes, there are landslides. Do you know that there's landslides today? We know that the sea tides, there's landslides of about an inch. Most people, you know, fortunately, it doesn't affect us much. We're having major landslides here. A polar shift of about 5 degrees would lengthen the day, apparently. Meteors would follow about 2 to 3 hours later, traveling at about 30,000 miles per hour. Now, what's interesting about this whole episode is, thanks to Emanuel Velikovsky, his research revealed that at about the same time we have this record by the way, Velikovsky was not a biblical believer. But at the same time we have this apparent record in the Bible, he discovered that there's a legend in China of the Long Night. The Long Night of China. There's an emperor that came to power because he solved the problem of the Long Night in the Chinese folklore. Interesting. Well, we could spend a lot of time on this because it's interesting stuff. Let's move on. The basic campaign, of course, in the south in Joshua 10, after the Treaty of the Gibeonites, is the Battle of Beth Horon, which causes a rout. Joshua followed up with quick surprise attacks all the way through that region and mops up the southern part, the powerful part of the land. What follows is the northern part of the campaign in Joshua 11. King Jabin of Hazor is panicked. He gets an alliance organized. Joshua goes up and by hitting hard, quick strikes, decimates that group. And what follows is a slower guerrilla war as they try to mop up the rest of the land. The book of Joshua has been compared to the book of Ephesians in spiritual terms. This is worth mentioning. Alan Redpath's famous for this. A book called Victorious Christian Living compares Joshua with Ephesians. Joshua, of course, deals with Israel, Ephesians with the church. Joshua is all about entering and possessing, so is Ephesians, entering and possessing our heavenlies. Joshua is an earthly inheritance. Ephesians deals with our heavenly inheritance. Joshua was given in Abraham. Our success is given in Christ. Each of these is opened by a divinely appointed leader. Each is given grace but received by faith. And each striking divine revelations. Each is a scene of warfare and conflict. Now, the one reason I point this out, most people don't realize that you and I are in conflict. Not like Joshua was. Yes, like Joshua was. We're going to get to Ephesians, and you'll be startled that you are instructed on your armor. Ephesians will give us the intelligence report and tell us what we need to do. We are in a combat zone. We are in enemy territory, and we are both the pawns and the prizes in this conflict. We'll get to that when we get there. There's a military, in each of the, in Joshua and Revelation both, there's a military commander dispossessing the usurpers. There's a 7-year campaign against 7 of an original 10 nations. The Torah is ignored at Jericho. The Sabbath is ignored. The Levites are involved and so on. They first send in 2 witnesses. There are 7 trumpet events that occur. It's preceded by silence in heaven in half an hour in the Revelation case, just as there was silence in the Jericho case. In each case, the enemies are confederated under a leader in Jerusalem. In Joshua's case, it's Adonai Zedek, the Lord of Righteousness. Of course, the Antichrist in the Revelation. Each are ultimately defeated with hailstones and fire from heaven, with signs in the sun and the moon and so forth. I think the parallelism is startling. You either see it, you don't. I'll leave it to you to look at it. And of course, the kings hide in caves, saying, "Rocks, fall on us and hide us from the wrath of the Lamb," in Revelation chapter 6. Interesting parallelism. Both military books. And of course, we'll get at the one book of Revelation. The rest of the book of Joshua deals with dividing the land. They've now conquered the land, essentially. And the tribes drew lots. The lot is in the lap of the Lord, the scripture says. There's no such thing as a random event in God's kingdom. The tribes were allocated their portions by casting lots. Manasseh had half the tribe earmarked the area east of the Jordan. Gad and Reuben, half of Manasseh, Gad and Reuben wanted east of the Jordan, the area that we know today as the Golan Heights. Asher's up north, Naphtali up near the Nazareth area, Zebulun between the two. Issachar a little to the south, the other half of Manasseh right there in the mid-range. Ephraim, still part of the northern group, but further south. Ephraim becomes synonymous with the whole northern group when the kingdom splits up. Tribe of Dan is in the mid of the range, but they need more space, so they get some additional room up near the top. The Tel Dan is up in the northern tip of the country. And Benjamin is south. In fact, Jerusalem is technically right on the border in Benjamin. And Judah and Simeon to the south. So they're the 12 tribes. The Levites didn't get land as such. Their inheritance was the Lord. So they were assigned 48 cities. I won't detail the 48 cities. Some of them we're not sure exactly where they are. But six of those 48 cities were designated cities of refuge. And there were six of them, three east of the Jordan and three west of the Jordan. Now, the cities of refuge are another interesting challenge. You realize there were no prisons in Israel. That's provocative to think about. So what did you do if somebody got murdered? Well, the first question, was it premeditated or was it what we call manslaughter? The next of kin had the responsibility to establish justice. Now, if you were engaged in something where it was an accidental death, what we would call manslaughter, what you needed to do is flee, and flee right now to a city of refuge. You need to know where they are in case you've got a problem. You need to get to a city of refuge. If you could get to a city of refuge, you were secured against the avenger of blood. You knew that the next of kin would be after your skin. But if you were in the city of refuge, and you could convince the city fathers this was not a premeditated murder situation, they would give you asylum. The avenger of blood, this next of kin, could not touch you as long as you were in the city. If you left the city, you're fair game. But if you're in the city, you're all right. And this situation stayed that way until the high priest down in Jerusalem died. Once he died, all bets are off. You're free to go wherever you like. Now you say to yourself, this is pretty weird tribal. You know, many commentators say, this is just, you know, the ancient tribal way of trying to deal with the situation. I don't think so. I think everything in here is for our learning. This is a pretty strange situation. Let's talk a little bit. Let me ask you a question. Jesus Christ on the cross, was that premeditated murder or manslaughter? From God's point of view, it was premeditated because it was his predetermined counsel that Jesus was on that cross. But from our point of view, yours and mine, was it premeditated or manslaughter? Remember what Jesus said on the cross? Father, forgive them for they what? No, not so. I can argue the case that we're in our case, it is manslaughter. The crucifixion of Christ is thus, I believe, from our point of view, manslaughter. So we're secured against the avenger of blood as long as we're in the city of refuge. Who's our city of refuge? How secure are we in Jesus Christ? 100%. For how long? Until the high priest dies. Who's our high priest? Jesus Christ. And it's his death that frees us. Interesting possibility. Let me mention another thing that's in the law. I love these little tidbits because they're illumination. Back in Moses' day, they were talking about inheritance, and this guy by the name of Zelophehad had five daughters, no sons. And so they were stuck because the inheritance went through the men. So the daughters of Zelophehad go to Moses and say, hey, we got a problem. There's five of us, no sons. Can you make an exception for us? Well, Moses is not about to do that on his own. He goes before the Lord. The Lord says, do it. So Moses puts in the law an exception. that if there's daughters and no son, and they marry within the tribe, that the inheritance rights can flow, the parent can flow through the daughter. Okay? Okay, now when we get to Joshua, and they're in the land, this is 40 years later, more than 40 years later, these five daughters come to Joshua and say, hey, we've got some fine print for us in the law. Check it out. Joshua does. There it is. And he honors that. Now, I can't find a commentary that recognizes, there may be a few that I need to double back and check, but that most of them just say this is just another one of these quaint procedures in the Torah. I don't think there's any quaint procedure in the Torah. I think they all point to something relevant and all about Jesus Christ. Daughters of Zelophehad has this exception on the rules of inheritance. It was requested of Moses in Numbers 27, granted by Joshua in Joshua 17. What many people don't realize that in Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 7 and Numbers 32 and 1 Chronicles 2, what happens in these cases when there's a daughter of Zelophehad type and she marries within the tribe, the husband she marries is officially adopted by her father as his son. Okay? We would call that a son-in-law. They didn't have that term, but that's what happens. Now, this anticipates the lineage of Jesus Christ. I think it was C.I. Schofield, not in the Schofield Bible, but in some other writings of his, he was the first to recognize that the claims of Christ hang on this exception in the Torah of the daughters of Zelophehad. And we'll diagram that for you when we get to Luke chapter 3. Well, now we're in the book of Judges. Judges is approximately 450 years, it covers about the 450 years following the conquest. There are 400 years segments in the nation's history from the birth of Abraham to Joseph and Joseph to Exodus and from Exodus to the monarchy and from the monarchy to the exile. Each of them are roughly 400 years. I'll give you a better analysis shortly. That's just a sort of a horseback perspective. Now, it's interesting. There's a record here in Judges of occasional deliverers rather than a succession of governors. It probably was written by Samuel prior to the accession of David, but that's speculation. The recurring theme all through the book of Judges is that everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So we're talking immorality. The cost of compromise. You know, it's interesting. After Joshua and all that, another generation arose. They were unwilling to help the rest. They were living among idolaters and thus became contaminated. The surrounding nations exploited their degeneracy, their incomplete mastery of their heritage, their military alliances, their intermarriage. Apostasy and idolatry were the result. Very pathetic anticlimax to the heroics of the book of Joshua. What we're going to see in the book of Judges, God's occasional interventions interrupted this sordid slide into failure. There are six servitudes in the book of Judges. These servitudes are not accidents. They're brought on deliberately by Jehovah as punishments for their failure. Privileges are not a license to sin. The pattern in each one of these is they were sinning, they suffered, they repented, and then a deliverer was raised to deliver them. I won't get into all the details, but there are six of these. There was a servitude in Mesopotamia. The deliverer was Othniel. It lasted 8 years. The Moabites had them in servitude for 18 years. Ehud was the deliverer. The Canaanites had them in servitude for 20 years. Deborah was the deliverer. Midianites had them in servitude for 7 years. Gideon was their deliverer. The Ammonites, Jephthah, 18 years. The Philistines had him in subjection for 40 years. Samson was the deliverer. When you add up these years in servitude, it adds up to 111 years, and I'll explain how that's relevant here in a few minutes. It's kind of interesting that the history of Israel seems to be rendered in 70-week segments, 490-year segments. But in each case, you take the actual calendar and subtract out when things are not the way they should be. From Abraham to Exodus, from the promise in Genesis 12, 4, it's 75 years, and plus the 430 that Galatians 3 talks about. So it's 505 years we can account for from Abraham to the Exodus. But there's 15 years that Ishmael, in effect, is a usurper. And when you subtract that out, it's 490 years, interestingly enough. From Exodus to the temple, it begun, of course, in 1 Kings 6 through 6 through 8, in about 494. It was completed 7 years later for a total of 601 years. However, these servitudes of Judges as I've just gone through, there's a handful of these that we've just read off, add up to 111. You take the 111 from 61, you have again 490 years. We're going to discover when we get to Daniel that the history of Israel seems to involve four 490-year periods. In each case, the total calendar time, you subtract out the time that they're in servitude or in dispersion or what have you, and it separates out. So we'll look at that when we get there. There is one very sordid conclusion to the book of Judges, and it seems to be an episode that is recorded for historical reasons, but also to give you a feeling for the time. There's a Benjamite. He's actually a Levite. It's in the region of Benjamin. He's a Levite, but he's also a Benjamite. And he has a concubine. And he travels to repair his marriage. But he's unable to find safe lodging. Because he couldn't find safe lodging, his concubine is raped and left for dead. He is really upset about this, so he cuts her into 12 parts and mails them, so to speak, sends them to the 12 tribes. This causes an outrage throughout Israel against the Benjamites in that region, and these outraged tribes come to, in their self-righteousness, to attack the Benjamites. They virtually eliminate the tribe of Benjamin. There's only 600 left when this is over. And the pendulum swings the other way. The other tribes are shocked to realize that they've almost wiped out their the legacy of this tribe. So they end up assisting the 600 remainers to get brides and so forth in order for the tribe to survive. Very strange episode, but very dismal. That sort of closes the main issues of Judges, and I'm very anxious very quickly now to get into a more pleasant subject, probably one of the most pleasant in Scripture, the book of Ruth. But the book of Ruth opened in the days that the judges ruled. So this charming little book happens to occur in this dismal period called the book of Judges. It, in many respects, speaks of the ultimate love story. You can't find a better one. That's at the literary level. Many college courses study the book of Ruth just as a piece of literature, not understanding the supernatural basis of it. But also at the prophetic and personal level, it's the ultimate love story. It also turns out to be one of the most significant books for the church in the Old Testament. That almost sounds like a contradiction in terms, but bear with me. Because it deals with the role of the Goel, the kinsman redeemer. We understand what a kinsman redeemer is because of the episodes in the book of Ruth. And I'm going to suggest to you that the book of Ruth, this little four-chapter book, is an essential prerequisite to the study of the book of Revelation. It's interesting how in the genealogy of things, it's always the 10th man that's significant. From Adam to Noah, from Shem to Abraham, and from Isaac to Boaz, who's the hero of the piece of the book of Ruth. Noah, Abraham, and Boaz are the 10th man in each case. The book of Ruth. Chapter 1 is about love's resolve. It's about Ruth cleaving to her mother-in-law, Naomi. Chapter 2 is about love's response, where Ruth is gleaning for the two of them under the laws of gleaning in Bethlehem. And then the chapter 3 is love's request, and we have this interesting, often misunderstood, threshing floor scene. And the climactic chapter is love's reward, the redemption of both the land and the bride in chapter 4. Chapter 1, in the days the judges ruled. The famine drives a family to Moab. Elimelech and Naomi are married. They have two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, and they're starving because there's famine in the Bethlehem region, so they go to nearby Gentile region called Moab. In that region, Elimelech dies, so Naomi's a widow. In that region, Mahlon and Chilion both take brides of the Moabites, but they both pass away, leaving Naomi with two daughters-in-law. By the way, Naomi means pleasant, like pleasant land or Israel. She'll turn out to be symptomatic of Israel. Mahlon is unhealthy or to blot out, and Chilion means puny or to perish. These are rough names. Now, Naomi naturally deters her daughters-in-law from following her. By the time this happens, 10 years have gone by, she's going to go home because things are now better back in Bethlehem. Orpah and Ruth, her two daughters-in-law, they're Moabites, want to stay with her. That tells you a lot about Naomi. She was a pretty cool gal, apparently. Orpah and Ruth both choose to go with her, but Naomi talks them out of it. Orpah finally does return. She stays in Moab, but Ruth will not be deterred. She insists upon staying with Naomi. Her name, by the way, means desirable. Now, Ruth's dedication is classic. Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave thee nor return from following after thee, for whither thou goest, I will go. And where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. And where thou diest, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also. If aught but death part thee and me. This is Ruth to her mother-in-law. So she hangs in there. Chapter 2 of Ruth is gleaning. And these are just highlights. There's much more here, but I'll try to be brief. To understand chapter 2, you have to understand the law of gleaning in Leviticus 19 and Deuteronomy 24. The way they had welfare in those days, if you owned a parcel of land, your reapers could go through once and only once. What you reapers missed were fair game for the destitute, the orphans, the widows, what have you. That was the way they did it. So you tried to be efficient, but what you left was available as a form of welfare. Provision for the destitute. Now, chapter 2 says that Ruth happens upon the field of Boaz. I love that phrase because you remember what the rabbis tell us, that happens or coincidence is not a kosher word. God's hand, God's fingerprints are all over this thing. Boaz, the word means in him is strength. And by the way, one of the temple pillars when the temple is finally built is named Boaz. There's a lot going on here. Boaz is introduced to Ruth by an unnamed servant. The flag should go up. Gee, that's usually the Holy Spirit in some role as an unnamed servant. Boaz is the hero of the piece. He's going to be the kinsman redeemer. He's the man of the hour. Ruth is a Gentile, will end up being a Gentile bride of him. Let's see how this goes. So Boaz, he sees this young gal that's among the gleaners. He tells his men to protect her. Don't let any harm come to her. He also instructs his reapers to drop handfuls on purpose. He's a Goel, which is the Hebrew for a kinsman redeemer. We'll discover how that goes. There's a law of redemption in Leviticus 25. If that a woman is a widow, her husband's died, he has had no sons, that she can go to the next of kin and ask him to perform the kinsman's part and raise up issue for her. He doesn't have to do it. There are some conditions, and he can choose to not do it if he chooses, and we'll see how that works in a minute. But the law of redemption, one of the values, the many values of Ruth, one is we get an idea of how ancient Israel operated. There's many lessons here for us. There's also the law of Levirate marriage. There's two different laws here. I mentioned the law of redemption is when the widow could go to him to raise up issue. The law of redemption is when you sold a piece of property, you didn't really sell it. You did what we would call a lease. It wasn't fee simple. It was what you sold was the use of the land for a period of time. Your next of kin could come back and redeem it, and the deed had the conditions for redemption written on the outside. The deed was on the inside, written on, within and on the backside. We'll encounter that when we get to Revelation chapter 5. Well, we get to chapter 3. Meanwhile, when Ruth comes back to Naomi, she has an enormous amount of gleaning, and of course, Naomi smells a rat. What's going on here? And she smells it. She's fallen into somebody's benefaction here. But she also discovers that she happens to be in the field of Boaz, and Naomi figures this out. She says, wait a minute, Boaz is our kinsman. And she realizes there's a play here that will not only benefit Naomi, but primarily her motivation is for Ruth. Ruth's been so faithful to her. Her reputation's all over town by now, of course, for lots of reasons. Naomi says, you do exactly what I say. There's a chance here to really do a major ploy for Ruth's benefit. Chapter 3 is the threshing floor. And Naomi recognizes the opportunity that there's this kinsman there. Not only for the redemption of her land that was sold back 10 years ago, but for a new life, a whole new life for Ruth. So she instructs Ruth on what to do. And what happens in a threshing floor, the men during the day are thrashed. A threshing floor is typically a saddleback where there's a prevailing wind. And what they did with they would thrash the grain and throw it up in the air when the wind was blowing. If they did it properly, the good stuff would fall nearby because it's heavy. The stuff you didn't want was lighter, and the wind would blow it further down. If you did this properly, you ended up with two piles downwind. The first pile was your marketable grain. You'd bag that and get it ready for market. The rest of the stuff you'd burn to avoid vermin and so forth. That's what a threshing floor is all about. What they did, they worked all day, and then at night there was a celebration. But the owners of the grain would sleep there to protect it, to keep it from being stolen. So there's a whole procedure that she's going to take advantage of. Naomi tells her, watch where Boaz is going to sleep. And it's dark and no one's around. You go and sleep at his feet. Which is exactly what she does. Now what she does is often misunderstood unless you have some background. Because it sounds like when Boaz wakes up, there's a girl at his feet. He's quite startled. And she asks him to put his skirt over her. The naive reader says, gee, it sounds like she's sexually propositioning him. No, it's worse than that. She is putting a claim on him as a near kinsman. Putting the skirt, you have to understand how hems were in Israel. Hems were the badge of authority. We have authority on the shoulders or on the sleeve, stripes, like an admiral or a captain, whatever. In the ancient cultures, your authority, your genealogy, your stature was on the hem of your garment. That's why David cut off Saul's hem. It was his genealogy, his authority as a king. That's why the woman with the issue of blood, we'll talk about this when we get to the Gospels, if she could push through and just touch the hem of his garment, in their mind, the hem was the authority. God says in Isaiah, I'll put my skirt over you, meaning God's going to put his protection over Israel. She's asking Boaz to put his protection as a house over her to take her to bride. He is flattered. He says that this is the kindest thing you've done yet. Because he's older. He's mature. She's a young, attractive young gal. He'd love to, but he says, unfortunately, there's a problem. At this point, this is where the plot thickens. There is a nearer kinsman. But what he does, he gives her 6 measures of barley to take back to Naomi. Most readers don't pick it up. That's a code. Naomi, she's Jewish. She'll figure that out. 6 measures of barley, 6 days of work. That's a signal to Naomi that he will not rest until this issue is resolved. It's a very positive signal to Naomi. And then we get to chapter 4. Boaz is apparently one of the 10 at the gate. He calls the nearer kinsman's coming by. He calls him to counsel. He's got 10 people for witnesses. He asks the nearer kinsman. He explains that Naomi has his property that needs to be redeemed. The nearer kinsman says, no problem, I'll be glad to do that. That's where he sort of winced. That wasn't what he wanted to hear. He says, oh, but by the way, whoever does that also has to take Naomi for a bride. Whoops, can't do that. It'll mar my own inheritance. So he has to pass. As a symbol of passing, he takes off his shoe and gives it to Boaz. That was a traditional sign of reneging on the opportunity. If you chose not to do the nearer kinsman, a form of disgrace was to give your shoe to the affected party. So he yields his shoe to relieve the obligation. Boaz is delighted. He was hoping that was the answer because he steps up to take this all on. He purchases the land for Naomi, and he purchases Ruth as a bride. But then in the celebration that follows near the end of chapter 4, there's some strange things that happen. This is the big upbeat chapter because he gets the bride and Naomi gets the land and everything's great and they've got this party going on, it would seem. And there's what sounds like a toast. May your house be like Perez. Well, that sounds good unless you know what Perez was all about. You go back to Genesis 38, it's a strange prophecy. In Ruth 4, verse 12 says, and let your house be like the house of Perez, who Tamar bare unto Judah, the seed of which the Lord shall give thee of this young woman. What on earth? You and I say, gee, that sounds pretty good. If you understand this verse, you feel like saying, same to you, fella. Tamar was the daughter-in-law of Judah. Her husband died. It was Judah's responsibility to get her a husband, and he failed to do that. He didn't get around to it. Judah happens to be on a trip. Tamar poses as a prostitute with a veil and all that on a hill. And Judah goes in under her. He gives her a pledge of his signet and his staff and some things, so he'll return the money later. When he gets home, he sends a courier to send the money to this prostitute, and he discovers the courier comes back. There's a prostitute there. There never was. This isn't. So he's puzzled. Well, then he finds out that his daughter-in-law is pregnant, and he's really upset that someone has got her, you know, in a family way, as you might say. She's not married. And then she's confronted. He says, whose signet is these and whose staff? Then he realizes that she was the prostitute that he impregnated. And he's upset, not with her, with himself, because he realizes it was his sin by not getting her a husband that led to this whole mess. The illegitimate child that's born to Tamar is Perez, or Perez, depending on how you want to pronounce it. It's in the family tree of Jesus Christ for some reasons we'll come to. So here, knowing all that, these people say, may your house be like the house of Perez whom Tamar bore to Judah, of the seed of which the Lord shall give thee of this young woman. You hear, wait a minute, what kind of a toast is that? Bear with me. You need to know from Deuteronomy 23, verse 2, that a bastard will not enter into the congregation of the Lord until the 10th generation. It takes 10 generations to purge the illegitimacy. He shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. Well, let's take a look at the Perez, the genealogy. From Perez, we get Hezron, Hezron to Ram, Abinadab, Nashon, Salmon to Boaz, to Obed, to Jesse, to David. The 10th generation of Perez turns out to be none other than David, the king, ultimately the king. Now, we're at the time of Boaz. Boaz and Ruth are going to have Obed as a child. Obed will grow up and have Jesse as a child. Jesse will have David. David is the 10th generation of Perez. This, what sounds to us like a toast in Ruth 4, is a prophecy of David being the king. Puts a whole different complexion on 1 Samuel. We always think that Israel wanted a king and God gave him a king reluctantly because they kept clamoring for it. God had a king for them in mind. They were just impatient. So he gave him Saul for a while to find out what a king can be like. Different perspective, isn't it? All from this little book called Ruth. Now, question. Where was Jesus Christ born? What town? Bethlehem. Why was Jesus born in Bethlehem? Because it was the what? City of David. When did connected Bethlehem to David? Answer, Boaz and Ruth. Interesting. You see, I believe that night at the manger scene and the shepherds came. Those shepherds were shepherds in the fields that originally belonged to Boaz and Ruth. I think there's a connection. Boaz is in the role of the kinsman redeemer, the Goel. There's some requirements for a kinsman redeemer. He has to be a kinsman. In other words, he has to be able to perform. He has to be willing to perform. And he must assume all the obligations of the one that he's benefiting. Not, you can't pick and choose. Jesus is our kinsman. He became a man so that we might live. He certainly is able to perform, but he also has to be willing to perform. He was crucified on a cross of wood, yet he made the hill on which it stood. It wasn't the nails that held Jesus to that cross. At any time, he could have said, enough already, I'm out of here. What held him to that cross? His love for you and I. See it all the way through. He was willing. And he also assumed all the obligations of his benefit. Now, Boaz was the Lord of the harvest in the book of Ruth. He's also our kinsman redeemer. And by the way, there's a flip side of the kinsman redeemer. It's called the avenger of blood. Naomi, of course, is in the role of Israel, Ruth, the Gentile bride. Some interesting observations. In order to bring Ruth to Naomi, Naomi had to be exiled from her land. That's interesting. What the law could not do, Ruth was a Moabitess. The law prohibited marrying a Moabitess. What the law could not do, grace did. Ruth does not replace Naomi. Many people say church replaces Israel. No, 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 no. Church does not replace Naomi. Her inheritance is of a totally different kind. Ruth learns of Boaz's way through Naomi. Naomi never meets Boaz directly in the story. Yeah, she does, but I mean the story she didn't. Naomi meets Boaz through Ruth. Ruth learns of Boaz's ways through Naomi. Naomi meets Boaz through Ruth. Do you get the picture here? And by the way, at the threshing floor scene, no matter how much Boaz loved Ruth, he had to wait for her move. Have you received Jesus Christ? He's waiting for you to make your move. But it's interesting, too, that it's Ruth's job to confront the nearer kinsman. No, no, Boaz did it for her. He interceded for her. Boaz, not Ruth, confronted the nearer kinsman in chapter 4. Book of Ruth is always read at the Feast of Pentecost, Shavuot. I think that's interesting because the Feast of Shavuot, I believe, is a rumble of the church. And you can't really understand Revelation 5, the seven-sealed book and all of that, without understanding thoroughly the Book of Ruth. And as I said, you and I are beneficiaries of a love story that was written in blood on a wooden cross erected in Judea almost 2,000 years ago.